This Dharma talk was recorded live at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. If you enjoy these talks and wish to support the temple and its offerings, please visit austinzencenter.org. Thank you for listening.
Since some people have just joined us, I just want to welcome again Heather Martin, a long-term practitioner of the Dharma in the lineage of San Francisco Zen Center, coming to us by way of...
It's hard to say.
San Marcos and also San Antonio, lay entrusted Dharma teacher. And not a stranger to us, maybe to some of you. So anyway, thank you for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
As Tara mentioned, it's hard to say where I'm from. So I say I'm from Zen of No Abode. So when I started in San Antonio, there was no San Antonio Zen Center. Austin Zen Center is actually my temple heart. I was offered Dharma entrustment by Colin Gibson of the San Antonio Zen Center, and I've practiced there more than anywhere else. But I now live in San Marcos, so, you know, we'll just see what happens here. So I would like to start with just a short verse with an odd coincidence from Master Sengsan of the Kwan Un School of Zen. Good and evil have no self-nature. Holy and unholy are empty names. In front of the door is the land of stillness and quiet. Spring comes, grass grows by itself. Although Zen practice asks you to let go of stories, we also use stories in order to teach, so I have one for you today. And if you read these stories from different teachers, you find that they refer to each other a lot. And that verse from Master Sengsan has a reference to a haiku by Basho. So I was reminded the other day to think about how long I've been practicing. And I can only ever figure it out by thinking about how old my child was when I started practicing. So I thought about it and it's been 20 years, which I remember that sounding momentous. I thought I would talk a little bit about my experience of that time when I first started practicing. Just the first few years. And my big question, one of my big questions at the time was, I was trying to understand what karma is. So if you've been around for a while, you may have read a version of this Dharma talk. So if that's the case, I apologize for the repetition. But actually it bears repeating. So this Dharma talk is based on a true story. Just before I started practicing, we moved into a new house. And it was outside of town on about a quarter of an acre. And it was, I think it was fall, maybe going into winter when we moved in. And the lawn was dead until spring came. And the grass grew by itself. And because it was so far outside of town, there was all this life that I had never really seen before. A lot of different kinds of wildflowers, and there was a horned lizard, roadrunner, that used to come by every day. But my favorite thing that was new to me were these caterpillars. They were maroon with orange dots, and they had little horns all over them. And then if you touched them, an extra pair of horns would come out of the back of their neck. And it smelled bad. It would like deter predators. It was so cool. And eventually those turn into black swallowtail butterflies. But while they're caterpillars, they only eat pipevine, which was a little plant that was indeed growing here and there in the lawn. But the previous owner had been charitably inattentive to the lawn. And so pretty quickly it turned out that the really brightest green grass was sandburrs. and they were really thriving along the sidewalk because the water, the rain would pool and stay under the sidewalk, and they were just really happy to be alive right there where we walked to the car. So on the way to the car, I would pull seeds off to throw them away, thinking that the plants would die without being able to reseed and they would be gone. But they kept growing. So I started pulling them up by hand. And when sandbars have been growing for a while and you grab it around the middle, you're gonna pay for it. And then as you pull it up and it pricks your fingers, it also only pulls up out of the middle. And there are these little sprouts all around the edge. So I noticed after a while that they would just, I'd pull one up and then there would be this ring of sandburrs where I had pulled it up. So I was kind of cussing the previous owner under my breath while holding my two-year-old to the car. So it wasn't very long before I noticed them sort of spreading out into the open, sunny part of the yard. And my child fell one day, and when he stood up, he was screaming. And he had, I don't know, 10 burrs in his little baby hands. And pulling them out was, I still get chills, agony. Those, if you're not from here or have a well-maintained yard, you may not be familiar, but sandburrs, when they dry, the spines go in different directions. So when you step on one, the burrs are, you know, pulling it out is very painful. It's not like a splinter. And I left these little red dots on his fingers for days, and that is when I got the shovel. And the blades of the sandburrs looked so similar to the grass growing around them that I could only find them by looking for the seeds for the fruit. So I would see a little cluster of those, and I would follow the stem back to the center of the plant, and I would feel carefully around the edges and then dig it up. And it was easy enough, actually. They were pretty shallowly rooted. So the path that we walked every day was clear. And they didn't resprout until the following spring. And then they seemed to be everywhere I looked. And I was not happy. And I remember looking out and seeing the neighbor's burrs sort of growing through the fence and dropping its malignant little seeds into my yard. And then I remember looking out the window one day and seeing a cat trucking home. And he stopped and, you know, starts taking a bath. And I saw him pull a burr and fling it. And there's no controlling that, even if you don't have a cat. I tried mowing more often. And if you do that, they learn to grow low. And they just, it's amazing. They just put out these sort of runners with seeds on them instead of standing up. So I kept digging, just cussing the former owner and my neighbor and the cat for just like thoughtlessly undoing my work. And then one day, I really don't even know why. If you have a big yard, there's always a corner where nobody goes. And so one day I went to the corner where nobody goes. And it turns out that sandburrs actually grow the best if they are totally ignored and parched. They grow deep roots. They entangle themselves into an absolute carpet of evil. It's just that I had been looking in the well-traveled areas first. So I thought that's where they were. And realizing that was painful and disheartening. But I kept at it. And when you live out in the country and you're in your front yard, people driving by will stop, even if they don't know you. And they'll say, what you doing? And it felt strange to tell them what I was doing. I think that I knew it was unusual. But I would tell them, And they would say, well, you know, they just sort of nod and chuckle and say, well, good luck with that. But I think most people didn't mean it. And quite a few of them would tell me that there was no way except poison or fire, which they always thought was really funny. And they were going to be the first person to tell me that. But I didn't want to burn it down because I wanted to keep the caterpillars. And you can't burn your lawn and keep certain things. So I kept digging. And occasionally somebody would stop with encouragement or offer me advice about what kind of tool to use. And even when those tools didn't work for me, I really appreciated that. And every time my child got stuck, it deepened my hatred. And I was spending so much time on it that my child would have to whine for me to play with him. Because anytime we were outside, I would get sidetracked digging up burrs. So then I was in a hurry, just looking like any spare moment, you know. I would sort of always have the hand shovel ready and a gardening basket where I could throw them in there. And I was really working with violence, just tearing at it, you know, to the point that I would sometimes dig up grass that I wanted to keep. And I got jabbed so many times that I developed an allergy to the burrs, and my fingers would swell up. And then it was hard for me to even do other things. So I tried gloves, but the burrs went right through them. And another thing that I noticed wearing gloves, I couldn't feel the edges of the plant. It dulled my ability to understand what I was perceiving. So the third year, I had a new crop of burrs. And I noticed that many of them were growing in the exact places I knew I had dug up burrs before. So by paying very close attention, I realized that as the burr grows, it starts dropping seeds very early in its young life. And so there are dried burrs all in the roots of the plant. And if you just dig them up in a hurry and toss them away, you are actually planting seeds for the next round. So those were my burrs. They were not the previous owner's burrs. They were not the neighbor's burrs. They were not the cat's burrs. Those were my burrs. And I may have cussed out loud that time. So I slowed down. And it took me a long time. But I did eventually learn to rest. I learned to balance my time, to feel around the edges gently so I didn't hurt myself. And the difference was really subtle, but I did learn to tell the difference between a sand burr and regular grass before the seeds even sprouted. I started sifting through the dirt carefully to find seeds that were waiting. I stopped panicking every time my child got stuck. I stopped noticing where the seeds came from. And I just didn't think very much about whether there was any hope of really getting rid of them. And then I started to notice how beautifully green they were. And I have this really clear memory of noticing this one plant where the ground was sort of cleared. And I could see just it. And I can still see it. The leaves were curving in this just beautiful arc. and I could see the seeds, and they were so sharp, just so perfectly suited for their purpose. And there was this little tinge of purple at the base of the spines. And then with great appreciation and real reverence, I dug it up by the roots. So although I have not mentioned the Zendo or Zazen, the story is about my coming to understand the true nature of karma. And I wanted to talk about it because the question that I get the most is, how do I bring my practice into my daily life, out of the Zen Center and into my daily life? My hope is for this to illustrate that regardless of your activity, if you practice diligently and with patience and sincerity, you will not be able to keep it out of your daily life. So that's perhaps a short, mildly unconventional Dharma talk. But that is the end of it. So if you'd like to bring anything up, talk about aphids or... I didn't even go there.
It seems when you get rid of something, you leave a void, and you, maybe you can purposely fill that void with something more pleasant, and then the evil thing has nowhere to go.
I think you could just see what's from. Preparing the ground is critical.
So Stephanie likes to say, my wife, that weed is simply a plant that's growing where you don't want it.
That's right.
Yeah. Love your reference to no longer worrying about where the seeds came from. Just being very patient.
Mm-hmm.
It happened naturally.
Yeah.
You know, as a writer, I'm just so struck by the narrative arc of the story. It's so stunning, and it's encouraging for me in the sense that, oh my gosh, the particular is so universal.
Yes.
You know, oh, I have my own thing like that. It's not the birds, but it's that thing, you know, so.
I'm also a writer.
I know, that's what I said.
Yeah, I really enjoyed hearing about the burr obsession. That's just so relatable in different ways, different contexts. And for me, like, the real practice edge was when you had the preference for the caterpillars to sustain the caterpillars. Because I found in myself inhabiting the story, and many times when you were talking, I was like, scorch it, like destroy it, you know, like take a drastic measure, put yourself out of this long-term suffering and difficulty. But then when you said you had the preference to sustain the caterpillars, that's where things get tricky for me. It's like, oh, I have these preferences. Which ones am I going to honor? How am I going to, you know, continue to work with what I need to struggle with? So, yeah, thank you for that.
You know, the first line of trust in mind. The great way is easy for those who have no preferences.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to wonder whether that was meant to be a joke.
Thank you for your story and for being here with us. You mentioned suffering. It was part of an area that I kind of try to navigate oftentimes between the suffering that we are inflicting on ourselves and the suffering that is just part of life,
yeah.
Right? And so there seemed to be quite a bit of suffering.
There was a little bit
there. And so you could maybe elaborate, if you have thought about this in those terms, what was the suffering that you were inflicting on yourself in this moment?
Mm-hmm. When I dug at the birds with respect for their power and for my limitations, I didn't get stuck very often. But I couldn't control everything. I still did get stuck sometimes, even when I wasn't digging. And I had this child whose powers of discernment were less. It was my job to protect him. So I think that working with suffering at your own pace, diligently, but not being blind to cause and effect, you don't pile more on top. And you might notice that you stop worrying so much about making it stop, even as you continue practice. You might stop wondering when is the end. You might stop wondering whose fault is this. But you have to go slowly and don't treat your mind with violence.
When you mention viewing the weeds as like beautiful and noting their color, that kind of reminds me of like the concept of viewing adversity or suffering as like nutriment, sort of. Could you expound on like what you mean whenever you start appreciating basically the plant? That's like seems like a turning point.
I think that the turning point was actually neutrality. So although I did develop gratitude, I didn't tell myself that I should. I remember Reb talking about breaking his leg one time and saying that his first thought wasn't, oh, thank you. And that's what I want to caution against, is this gratitude beyond your natural capacity. And so something that I hear from people a lot is that they are perhaps working to stop judging themselves and continue to judge themselves, and then also get mad at themselves for judging themselves, which is not helpful. Although noticing it is helpful. So, you know, practice in the way that comes to you. But if you notice that it's not working, consider whether immediately jumping to gratitude for adversity is perhaps step two. That's step two. There's a step before that.
My experience with land is I walked in very codependent. I was going to rescue it. I was going to fix it. I was going to make everything that other people did wrong better.
And it's a long list.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yes,
it's a very lot of pressure. And the thing that finally gave me some relief was to realize, oh, look, this piece of land has been here for eons, like from dinosaurs with the fins on their back all the way to now. And that took some of the pressure off. Like, oh, it's not all on me. And there was a lot of I in all of that. I am going to fix it. I'm going to. And so in terms of karma, I look at people standing in the world and they look very uncomfortable a lot of the times, as uncomfortable as I am a lot of the time. And I think, I don't have to fix that. That's their karma. It's their thing. I can, but I don't have to do anything. You know, I don't have to fix it. So I do still chop a lot of thistle. But I also noticed that the butterflies really like that thistle. But I really don't want it, so.
Pleasure. I appreciate being here. I would like to gently ask you to revisit whether you can fix someone else's discomfort. Just think about it. Yes.
Heather, thank you so much for your talk. It was very real and incredibly rich, with so many things that my mind went through as you were talking regarding karma. The one thing was that this thing we do when we assign who caused something with our neighbor, cat, etc., that thing and that rabbit trail we run down, and what it does in preoccupying the mind and delaying our release of that whole scenario, working through that as you described, and then the realization of no separation, that these weeds, these burrs are everywhere, and we can't attribute in karma something to a person necessarily. It's kind of a time waster. I really enjoyed that, and it just really made me think of so many things. I'm gonna have to sit with you with your Dharma talk now for a couple of weeks.
There's no alternative.
Further.
I've doomed you.
So thank you.
Thank you. I was talking with someone about this at breakfast, but my relationship with my anxiety and depression is one of the things that brought me to practice. And I really thought that, I was like, oh, I'll get better coping skills and it'll go away.
Right.
yeah. And now I'm so grateful that I can come here and be depressed and still show up. And that's much nicer. But
just in case you didn't hear it, he said be depressed and still show up. I want you to hear that part.
Yeah. And I do remember there was one time I was saying to Choro about, I was like, I might be depressed for this retreat. I don't know what level, what Elliot's going to show up. And she's like, that's okay. But I was thinking about work and how I kept expecting my practice to just make the anxiety go away at work. But it's still there. And now I'm much more aware of like how hard it is for me to sit with it in that environment. And I was thinking about it, and I think it's something related to like the danger that's there. It's like when my anxiety's here, it's safe. I'm not going to hurt anyone. I can just sit still. But at work, my anxiety freezes me, and then I'll lose my job, and then I'll lose my house, and then I won't be able to do anything, right? And it just catastrophizes so quickly. And I was thinking about your story and how it seemed like the catalyst was really your son falling.
That's right.
So I don't think I wouldn't know how to practice at work and like make it through the day if I didn't practice here. So thank you. So I was going to ask you, at what point in that story did you come to a Zendo?
Around the same time that I moved, almost immediately. Make of that what you will. But I didn't hate the burrs until I really started noticing them. They were just a nuisance. And then when they hurt my child, that's when I was done. And you know, children or just other responsibilities, things like work, they're a barrier to practice, to coming to the Zendo. But they might also be your biggest impetus to keep going. So when I started to practice, I also believed that sitting still in a certain posture would prevent me from having feelings. So I did not get what I signed up for. anyone who's, this is your first visit, Zen actually asks you to become aware of your feelings and attend to them, which is not what I wanted, but that's what you get. Often hear people say that Zen practice benefits them. I don't recall a single case of somebody telling me that it benefited them in the way that they expected it to the first time they sat still. So if you hate this and like myself, have ADHD and feel like you're not paying attention right, and be not afraid. There's nothing wrong. Just ask for help.
Yeah, no, you started your talk with a quote about how there's not really a difference between good and evil, or these are maybe these constructs that we kind of have.
They're empty. Yes, I don't want to say that there's no difference, but okay. They are empty.
So that was part of my question was, you know, in your story, I noticed, so there was kind of this movement from hating the burrs to then having an appreciation for them and recognizing that the same thing that was causing harm to your son was also nourishing, you know, the butterflies. But at the end of the day, that didn't prevent you from taking action and deciding, okay, these are still, this is something I need to uproot. So I was just wondering if you could kind of speak to perhaps the paradox there of like, okay, good and evil are empty as concepts, and yet there is some sort of discernment needed in I guess, deciding how to address what's doing good, what's bringing harm. Yeah, how do you kind of hold the need for that action with, you know, the neutrality that you were talking about, or not having hatred for the thing that you're seeing causing harm?
You hold it gently. You know, Buddha was actually quite capable of making fine discrimination. I think the danger is if you assign value to this or that. Mm. So to me, there was some temptation to let the birds grow. But that is no better or worse than digging them up. And I found cultivating the ground to be less stabby, more pleasant. So why not? But I don't think that you should make those kinds of decisions without careful discernment.
Yeah, echoing the thanks. And I think you used the word unconventional, and I was going to say I love all things unconventional, so thank you. I also have a little kiddo, and I absolutely resonate with that idea of like, I'll pull up anything to, you know, prevent harm, thinking about what that means. Then I was thinking about land and our relationship to land, and thinking about indigenous lands and how we live on them, you know, and what our relationship is to the ground, the plants, you know, and how we think about the past. So I guess, I mean, you spoke about this, but I guess I'm wondering just if your relationship to not just the plants or the weeds, but whatever that distinction is or isn't, but the land itself, like,
do you mean did it grow?
Yeah, in part, I guess, and just thinking about I don't know what the question is exactly, but just maybe it's something about being in the present, you know, which we try to do, but knowing too that these lands have been forever and that other bodies have been there, and you know, what's our place there, and you know, and that there is no separation, but at the same time, you know, we owe so much to the peoples and the natural world that have come before us. So
I definitely thought about that. So some of my past training is in biology, so I think I had a natural interest, but I did think about that, looking at that one plant, how many millions of years of evolution went into the development of this weapon of mass destruction. And so I have huge respect for that. But I think what I want to say about connection to it is that we often, I think maybe possibly especially as Westerners, often have an oppositional relationship with nature. And we have this belief that our mind is something different. Your mind is not different than the rest of nature. It is entirely, utterly, irretrievably, not just connected, but of the same essential nature as everything you might see growing, every forming. It's the same. Right? Have you ever had a thought come up like that? remember with my second pregnancy, I was already meditating. And the baby got hiccups a lot. And I would be meditating, and the baby would start hiccuping. And it would be this thunk, thunk, with no control, you know. And I was looking at that and thinking, like, why, like, there's something in here that I should be studying. And I remember realizing that it doesn't matter at all whether you're pregnant, there's always something. So that connection, I think that's why we practice with the breath. There's this dual nature of it. We're all breathing the same air. There's not a hair's breadth difference between your breath and the person next to you, the, you know, dinosaur 100 million years ago. There's no difference. But when I breathe, you don't get oxygen. So there's this two edges. You can breathe on purpose, and your body will continue to breathe if you're unconscious. And so paying attention to that is instructive. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no.
It's a very big question.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't even know exactly what I was asking, so I appreciate that. No, that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk. I have a friend, Aiden, Kevin Heffernan. I don't know if you know him.
It's familiar.
Yeah, he practices in Richmond, Virginia. And it's a sangha that's affiliated with my original root temple in North Carolina. He's a conservation biologist. Mm-hmm. And he works for the state of Virginia. And he had an aha moment, even though this is what he does.
Right.
Meeting with some group. I think it was a group that he was trying to convince, they were putting up lots of solar panels, what to plant under the solar panels. So, you know, because they do a good thing, but they also cover the land. And he suddenly realized that the whole premise of, you know, invasives is a problem, right? That we talk about invasives, we talk about them as kind of extensions of our human colonial activity, mm-hmm. you know, and yet we can appreciate the sparrows. They're not native, right? They came over, all these birds, many birds, you know, were introduced to North America. Many animals, many plants, and then there's the accidental ones that just show up because life is lifing all the time.
That's right.
Right? So, you know, no, as human beings, we can't have no preferences, but we cannot be run by our preferences. So I think that balance that you're pointing to is important. Anyway, he changed his entire way of talking about invasives. And rather than eradicating and trying to get back to some original purity, from when, you know, from when the dinosaurs were here, when the whatever, you know, indigenous group was here, had their practices before all the trees were cut down, you know, how do we can't get back to some original, perfect Edenic moment. So for him it's a practice, how do I practice with what we have? Yeah. And then the intention that you, so, well pointed to intentional action of karma is a critical thing. What's my intention?
There's no easy answer.
No.
No easy answer. I just realized I might have forgotten Zoom too.
I'm usually pretty good about speaking.
Okay, good. Just holler or wave or something. I'm like, okay, looks okay.
It's kind of a bit hypocritical for us to call another species invasive, right?
Well, you noticed that.
There's a sign in our neighbors across the street that says, cease fire, everyone, everywhere, and their yard is completely just a wild place. So she goes and they go and, you know, kind of trim around the edges and deadhead things and whatever. It's not, you know, your typical urban lawn. And so when I see that, I see all this great life just,
right.
I think, and here in my yard, mm-hmm. ceasefire. Mm-hmm. Right. No children. There are no children.
Right. Yeah. So that's the thing, right? And sometimes that, you know, there's more than one interest to think of.
Yes.
That's difficult.
One thing that comes to mind is years and years ago, whenever my own kids were exploring the lawn, there was a time where my daughter fell and she put her hand straight into an ant pile.
Oh.
And there was a lot that came up of, you know, her getting bit, me feeling like I'd failed to like clear the lawn of dangers, and then it feels kind of that same way, like my kid got hurt by these sticker burrs. I must eradicate them all. And trying to eradicate ants, is that does not work. And it wasn't until I talked with other people around that they're like, yeah, you know, the ants are gonna come from neighbor's yards. You could get rid of them for a time, they'll come back. And the best thing to do is teach your kid how to recognize them so they'll avoid them and how to step away from them. And that bit of feedback had to come from people around me who were a step away from the whole thing, where they're like, that's not my kid that fell into the thing, so I can have a little bit of distance from that and be like, yeah, that was really uncomfortable, but it's going to be okay. You can't get rid of the ants. Just teach them how to avoid them, or you know, how to better deal with them. And so what's come up is that sometimes we're too near the thing, and it's really good to have a community that can give you a little bit of feedback. Like the people that came and saw you, like, oh, you're digging up all those? Yeah, good luck. You know. There's a little bit of feedback there that is like, you can't dig them up entirely, but good luck with that. I would encourage, as was helpful to me, to have community around that can point at the things of, you know, good luck with that, it's not going to work. You know, you can still work at it, but pull you back a little bit from diving your effort into something that, like me trying to get rid of ants, it wasn't going to work, and had to give it up pretty quick. But just putting out the idea of Sangha and community around you can help pull you back from.
Absolutely.
So I did have people who offered suggestions that I felt would be harmful to too many things around me. But I also had people who offered, you know, sometimes they would say, oh, there, I have this tool, you know, kind of works. But a lot of times it was just that they didn't sort of laugh at me for trying, you know, or that they were encouraging, you know, like, oh yeah, burrs, you know, if you got little ones, you can't just let them go crazy. So that this place is so valuable because everybody in here is trying. And when you're in your front yard, just you're going to get all kinds of suggestions. And some of them will be violent. Or some of them will be a little too Pollyanna. You know, just let it, just brush it off. Like with that.
So I heard you say that it sounds like you learned how to sort of change your actions over time. Like when you were sort of gentle with yourself, learning how to change. Like it seems like that's some of what you're saying, is that this, you can change your actions in response to your situation, and you're not stuck in a, I have to do it this way. So I have to just keep trying to learn how to improve the situation. Is that?
Yes. I think that what works best is to try to just observe. You might be going about some activity, but many times your initial response, your initial idea is not going to work. There may be some frenzy or violence to it, or might just be in some other way inadvisable, and that's okay. The important thing is that you are observing what you're doing and what the effects are. But it takes a long time. I not very many people guess right the first time.